All right, so tonight we are continuing our series on relationships, and we're continuing by looking again at dating as a relationship, particular relationship. Last week we talked about dating in terms of the beginning of a relationship and kind of two people coming together. I said it was the process of becoming in a dating relationship or going there, and tonight we're looking at dating being there. We're kind of looking at what some more characteristics about dating relationships and trying to get some wisdom from scriptures about what that might look like, how God might intend that. And just to kind of remind us of the big picture, we're doing this as a broader series on relationships. We began by looking at the fact that God isn't just interested in individuals. God doesn't just save people. He doesn't just, you know, zap you out of earth. What he's doing in the world is creating a community. God is inherently about relationships. And so we began by looking at that foundation of how the Bible begins with the problem of loneliness and ends with the solution of community. And that's the full story of the biblical revelation. And we've seen a little bit about how some of those things happen along the way. So we talked about parents. We moved outwards and talked about friends. We moved outwards again and we talked about neighbors and acquaintances. And now we're going back inside the circle. So now we're talking about dating, going back inside the kind of special friend. And then next week we'll start a two-week set on marriage, looking at how God designed marriage, when kind of a friend becomes a family and what happens there. And so we're seeing this flow of God's move in the world where he's reaching out and drawing in. And we've been observing that. And that's kind of the stage we're at in this process. And so now we want to talk about a bunch of questions like, what should it look like to be in a dating relationship? What should characterize it? How do you know where it's supposed to lead? How do you know whether it's a good relationship or a harmful relationship? How do you evaluate it? How do you enjoy it? How do you know when is right to move forward or move backward? A lot of us haven't had very good models for relationships. Certainly, the pictures we have in our culture, in media, and some of the people we know haven't been good models in terms of what makes a healthy relationship. A lot of our families haven't been good models. A lot of our parents are separated or don't have healthy relationships. Maybe our siblings haven't been good models. And so sometimes it's real hard to figure out what is it supposed to look like. And if you're in a relationship, you can find yourself saying, I don't know how to, you know, is this what it's supposed to be, or is it supposed to be something different? And I remember in some of my dating relationships, I'd often have the feeling, I know that relationships take work, but how much work is too much work? You know, how do I know, you know, two kind of dedicated, committed, tough it out people can probably make anything work, but how do you know if it's too much work and if you're kind of making something work that shouldn't inherently work? So those are the types of things we want to look at tonight a little bit. And I think one of the things that makes dating tricky is it's kind of a in-between relationship. It's a little bit of an awkward type of relationship, particularly in our culture, the way our culture has put it together. You know, you're not single, and yet you're not married. And if you're married as a Christian, then there are some pretty clear instructions. It's pretty clear that you're supposed to stay married. And you're supposed to work it out. And you're supposed to try and figure out, how do I love this person? What do I do with this problem? And you're supposed to work through those things. What makes dating complicated, I think, is that there's this combination of evaluation with commitment. You're kind of committed to this person because you've called it something. You've called it dating. You've had your DTR. You're at that level. But then you're still evaluating. And you could break up tomorrow, and that would be fine. And so figuring out that balance is really tricky to know. You can't completely apply the principles of marriage because you're not yet committed to this person and you're not necessarily supposed to make everything work. And yet you do want to make the relationship work. And so you want to spend energy. And that's a tricky place to figure out. So as we started last week, what we're going to do to try and get a sense of this is look back at Song of Songs, which, just to give another reminder, this is a really remarkable book in the scriptures. It's in the Old Testament. It's basically a collection of erotic love poems. And so it's this really incredible picture of two people falling in love, there's been a lot of debate about how to interpret it because it seems odd to a lot of people that this type of book is in the Bible. And so there have been a history of people saying, well, it can't actually refer to man and a woman. It can't actually refer to sex. It has to refer to spiritual ecstasy or some, you know, intimate relationship we have with God. And so there's all these efforts to kind of get around the fact that this book is really powerful. It's really steamy. It's really erotic in a lot of senses. And what do you do with that? It's in the Bible. Is that okay? Is that allowed to be? And one of the things we talked about last week is the idea that passion was created by God, that we think the world has a monopoly on passion, and yet you find passion in the scriptures. And to understand how passion can be lived out in its fullest and most appropriate is really an exciting journey to figure that out. So we're going to look at this, and I gave this disclaimer last week as well, but this is a poem, and so there's a lot of imagery and a lot of evocative stuff. And we're going to do our best to work through some of the images and try and pull out some principles. But when you do that, it's kind of like dissecting a frog. You know, you kind of have to kill the frog in the process. So we're going to lose some of the beauty of the poetry because we're going to be trying to figure out what it means. But I want to encourage you, maybe go back to it, realize that this is something powerful and it should stir something probably within you on an emotional level, not just on a intellectual, you know, notes and I understand this and that type of level. So we're going to walk through chapter 2, and I'm going to kind of read through it and make comments as we go. And so there'll be a lot of various comments, and what I'll try and do at the end is draw them together a little bit and give us a little bit of some package or some set of ideas that can help us in pulling all this stuff together. So as I said last week, Song of Solomon is written as a conversation. It's a conversation between a man and his beloved. And then there's this chorus, or the daughters of Jerusalem, or the maidens, or the kind of third parties that every now and then chime in. And so we're going to envision it as a as where we are comfortable with conversations. So this is like a chat text that the man and his beloved are having. And I went to extra work this week to try and pick appropriate emoticons for each text that the man and his beloved sent to each other. And I confess I did have to go to Wikipedia/emoticons to find all the lists because I didn't really have enough up my sleeve. But you can tell me how well I did. Okay. So let's start. This is Song of Songs, chapter 2. Let me find it. Okay, so it starts off with the woman. This is chapter 2, verse 1. She says, "I'm a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys." And the man responds, "Like a lily among thorns is my darling among the maidens." So we have to understand a little bit about this imagery to really see what's going on. It might, if you just read this first statement, "I'm a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys," you might think that she's confident. She's expressing confidence in herself. But that's because we don't know what these flowers are. So a rose of Sharon is kind of like a dandelion. It's a weed. And a lily of the valleys is a very, very common flower that's everywhere. And it's walked over. So she's actually, what she's saying is really nuanced, right? She says, "I'm a flower, but I'm not all that much of a flower," right? So there's this statement of what we get in this picture of a sense of how this woman views herself. She has some nature that she has beauty, that she is worthwhile, and yet she compares herself to the lowliest flower, to the most common flower. And so she's really, we saw this last week as well, she's insecure about her appearance. Last week she complained that she was too tan for cultural tastes, that she said, "Don't stare at me because I'm dark. I had to work outside all day." And so in that culture, the kind of ghostly pale was the epitome of beauty, which is different than our culture. So she says, "I am a rose of Sharon with a little frowny face," okay? And what the man does is really awesome. And men, we can learn from this. What he does is he takes her insecurity and he recasts it as a praise, as an affirmation. He says, "Well, if you're a lily, then you're a lily among thorns. Everybody else just pales in comparison to you." And so we see this picture of the woman expressing her insecurity and the man affirming her, reassuring her, praising her. Men, you can't really go wrong praising a woman. If you're dating somebody, if you want to date somebody, telling her she's pretty, telling her that she's a lily among thorns, that's never really going to backfire, okay? I suppose she could be creepy about it, and then maybe it'll backfire. But in general, affirmations of beauty, praising the women in your life, that's going to work out well. So this man knows this, okay? He understands a little bit about how it works. And the other thing that's interesting here that we can observe about dating and about this particular relationship is you see how she has a sense of who she is, and he helps to form that sense. And so what I want us to observe is the idea that our self-identities get formed in the context of relationships. Okay? Now this is a little bit, I think counterintuitive, because we live in this individualistic society where we like to think, you know, what do you do to find yourself? You run away, right? You run away from community. You go off alone. I need to go find myself. I need to go figure out who I am. And when we say that, we often mean I need to extract myself from other people so that I can figure out who I am. And yet, none of us exists independently of other people. And so, this can certainly go too far, where you allow other people to tell you who you are, where you don't have a sense of centeredness, of self-identity, and you just absorb the identity that other people give you. But in a healthy sense, this does happen, where we learn something about who we are based on the people we're connected with. Our self-identity gets formed in relationship, not just as individuals. And so you see that happening for this woman. How she thinks of herself is changed by the fact that she's in a relationship with this man. And I would say in a good relationship, in a healthy relationship, you start to see your sense of self developing in a positive manner. You start to see you growing, and you growing in a way that you're excited about, that you're pleased with. I've heard a lot of people say, as they're breaking up with people or they're in destructive relationships, they say, I don't like the person I was becoming in that relationship. And I've had that experience as well. I don't know if any of you have had that experience where you're dating somebody and you feel like you are changing, and who you are is becoming someone you don't like or you don't want to be, or you know that's not really who you are. And yet, in the context of this relationship, there seems to be a downward progression of your self-identity. I think that's a really important warning sign in a relationship, to say, how do you understand yourself? And in the context of this relationship, how is that understanding evolving? And is it evolving and growing in a direction that makes sense to you and that seems to be a positive sense, or does it seem destructive? There's this challenge in a relationship, right? So you figure out your self-identity grows and evolves, but then the relational identity grows. And so you're constantly figuring out, who am I in the midst of us? And that really carries forward in a marriage. We'll talk about that a little bit as we go into marriage the next several weeks. But this concept of, how do you understand myself in the context of a couple? And there's some relationship, but I remain an individual, but I am an individual connected to somebody else. One of the phrases that was really helpful for me in marriage is the phrase, oneness without sameness. How do I become one with somebody without just changing into them? And I often tell people that when I got married, I was very familiar with the verse that from Genesis that said, Adam and Eve, you shall get married and you shall become one flesh. Like, in marriage, you become one with your spouse. So I thought that meant that my wife would become me, right? doesn't that make sense? Like, for one, why not my one? And she can just kind of absorb into me, and we'll be happy. It didn't work that way, and that seemed to cause some conflict. I'm not sure why, but so we had to figure out, how do you become one with somebody without just being subsumed into them, without losing this sense of who you are? And that's this understanding of your self-identity as it grows in relationship and how that happens. So there's a lot there. But some of that is real just intuitive. You have a sense as you're relating to somebody, whether that's going well or going poorly. And the people around you can help you with that as well. Your community can help you to say, you know, when you're with in the context of that relationship, you're not the person you used to be. You're not the person I think you are. People will observe that about you, and you've probably observed that about some of your friends when they get in relationships that aren't healthy. They seem to change in ways that don't seem like good ways. So that's what we start with. She is insecure. He praises her, so he's got the happy face emoticon, mm-hmm. right? Okay. So then she responds, and she says what she thinks of her man. She says, I've never really understood that emoticon. Now I get it. It's a heart. I'm sure everybody knows that, but I didn't really know that. So, three? What is three? So she says, last to the party. All right. So she says, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. He has taken me to the banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. What's that? So this is really beautiful.
On the right side of the bed.
What's that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're snuggling, right? I mean, that's okay. So,
left arm under, right arm.
Left arm under, right arm embracing. Yeah, it's like a dance pose, right? So, the first thing I want to point out here is notice how both of them refer to each other in the context of other people. He says to her, like a lily among thorns, and she says to him, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest. So each of them recognize in the other some distinctiveness that makes them stand out from the crowd, essentially. And that's part of what happens when you start to be attracted to somebody and connected to them. You say, you are something that the people around you aren't. I recognize something in you that's unique. You stand out to me in a way that is attractive to me. And so that's the first thing that they notice, that they stand out to each other. And then you see the particular image, again, that the woman uses is a really interesting one. She says, like an apple tree is my lover. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. So, again, without destroying some of the beauty of the poetry, we can observe two things about this image that she uses. She says, you're an apple tree. And what she appreciates about him is that, essentially, he protects her. She can sit in his shade, and he provides for her. Your fruit is sweet to my taste. Your fruit is, what is it? Yeah, sweet to my taste. So there are these dual things of protection and provision that the man offers the woman. Now, this can seem old-fashioned. This can seem like, well, why does this have to be the man? Why can't the woman do this? And I'm not sure these are necessarily like transcultural demands that the man must be this way, and this is not so much a statement of manliness, but I do think that you can't go wrong as a man to offer these two things. That some sense of protection and providing for a woman is a really powerful way to take care of a woman. And on the flip side, what is the worst tragedy, what is the worst way for a man to be, is exactly the opposite. And you can recognize at the far end of the spectrum, a man who doesn't provide for the needs of a woman, but instead uses her for his own needs, and a man that instead of protecting her from harm that might befall her, actually inflicts harm on her. So you can see that the opposite of this is the definition of an abusive relationship. A man who doesn't protect and who doesn't provide. And so this is the picture that she praises him for. She says, I feel safe with you. I can rest in your presence. I feel protected by you. I know that you care about me enough to provide for me. And these are powerful things. These are powerful expressions of the way this man is willing to provide and the place in the life of this woman that he's willing to be. And she recognizes that and appreciates that. This image resonates with me personally, I think, in our marriage. I think this is something that we've experienced. And I've heard my wife say this in that sense, that this is something she longs for and experiences sometimes, and when she doesn't, I hear about it. but this is, I think, a helpful image for us, that she calls him an apple tree, that she praises his protection and his provision. The next thing she says is, he has taken me to the banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. And so what we want to observe about this is, he's not just willing to protect and provide for her in some secret, personal way. He's willing to go public with it. He's willing to say to the world, of all you out there, this is the one I choose. This is the woman that I want to be with. And, you know, sometimes you can get the sense that you're with somebody, and maybe you go into a public setting and you get the sense they're embarrassed to be with you. That usually doesn't work out so well, right? That's not the most attractive thing in a relationship, to feel like your significant other is embarrassed. You know, oh my gosh, they're going to meet you. What am I going to do? How can I avoid this? But that's not her sense at all. Her sense is that in public, in the banquet hall, he is proclaiming his love for this woman. And that's another powerful thing. I know that Rachel talks to me about this a lot, that my willingness to be, to display my affection for her, not necessarily like PDA or physical affection, but to say that she is whom I've chosen, that this is my woman in a public setting, is a lot more powerful to her than when we're in private, to be affectionate. And so this says something. This says something that I'm proud of this. And, you know, occasionally people start dating and they want to keep it a secret. They want to keep it a secret from the people around them. And sometimes there's good reasons for that, but that can't ever, that has to be a stepping stone to something further. You know, maybe you're trying to figure it out and you're not really sure if it's going to work and you want to kind of keep it in the DL until you know that you want to go public with it. But at some point, it's got to be a public relationship. At some point, there has to be this proclamation. We've chosen each other, and that's what's happening. So she's aware of that, and she appreciates it. And then what you notice then is that he protects her. He provides for her. He's going public with his love for her. What's her response? Strengthen me with raisins. Totally common, right? This crazy craving for raisins. I mean, we've all experienced that. Am I right? Probably not. But what's helpful to know is that they, in this culture, they saw fruits, and particularly raisins and apples, as aphrodisiacs. And so that there are places in the scriptures where you see them handing out raisin cakes, and you're like, raisin cakes? That's kind of odd. At one point in the life of King David, they win this big battle, and David sends home his army with raisin cakes. And it's like, okay, thanks. But what he's saying is, go home and do what you want to do. You know, this is, celebrate with your people. Have a raisin cake. Go for it. So that's what she's saying. And what you observe here is an increasing level of affection, of desire, of passion. This is like maybe PG-13 rated, maybe PG in today, maybe a decade ago it would be PG-13. But you know, this is an embrace. She is faint with love, and it gets even more steamy from here. But the sense is that as the relationship is going well, as she's confident of who he is and who he helps her to be, she desires to be with him, and she wants to be with him physically. She wants to have sex with him. That's the picture here. And that's a good thing. You know, sometimes I think Christians can get a bad rap because we have sexual ethics that are so different than the community around us and the world that we live in. And so sex can become this taboo thing, and you almost feel like sex inherently is wrong, and sexual desire is certainly wrong, right? Because all it does is get us in trouble. But what you see here is as the relationship develops, sexual desire increases. And so if you're dating somebody and you want to have sex with them, that's a good thing. You should want to have sex with them. You shouldn't have sex with them, but you should want to. And that should grow, and that should develop. And so that's what we see here. The next phrase then, what he says, is indicative of what's going on. So he says, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. And here's this kind of apathetic emoticon, right? So basically his message is wait. weight. Desire is increasing, sexual desire is increasing, and he frames this as a statement to the community around him, to the maidens, who would be kind of the young, unattached girls. He says to them, don't go too far too quick. Wait. Let love bloom, let love blossom in the appropriate timing, in the appropriate context, particularly sexuality. And so the scriptures are fairly clear that in a Christian context, that means no sex before marriage, that sex is something reserved for marriage. And so what we can see from this is there's an aspect of increasing desire, increasing affection, and yet waiting, holding on to that. And that's a challenging thing. That should be a challenging thing. If you don't want to have sex with the person you're dating, that's probably not a good thing. If there's not this sense of we're moving together and yet we have to wait, we have to control that, then that's something missing. And this is significant because waiting is one of the most repeated commands throughout Scripture. And so we've talked at different points in terms of how our romantic relationships connect with our spiritual relationship, connect with our relationship with God. And the idea of waiting comes up all throughout Scripture. Waiting on God, waiting on Him to act, waiting for the right situation. And so learning to wait with God is a really good skill to develop. Whether it's waiting for sexual desire to be fulfilled, whether it's waiting to be in a relationship, whether it's waiting for children or waiting for a job or waiting for whatever, you're going to have to wait in life. And if you're going to follow God, He asks us to wait. I mean, on a broad level, the place we're in right now in God's plan is a place of waiting. Christ has come. He started something. We have this taste of what life with God is like. And yet we still live in this world where we don't experience it all the way. We're waiting for God to complete His work. And so we have to live in this in-between stage. And so don't feel like if you're dating and you're struggling with waiting, or if you're not dating and you're struggling with waiting to be dating, don't feel like that waiting is wasted. Because there's a lot of God found during a time of waiting. That's a powerful season of life, no matter what it's for. And waiting doesn't end when you get married. If you have waited to have sex and you get married and you have sex in marriage, sometimes in marriage you have to wait to have sex too. That happens. Sometimes in marriage you have to wait to have children. Waiting is a universal experience, and fostering that sense of how do I wait with God is a powerful thing. The other thing I'd mention here is that if you haven't waited, or if you've made mistakes in previous relationships, which a lot of us probably have, whether it's having sex or going too far or dating people you probably shouldn't have dated or whatever, one of the most powerful things about being a Christian is forgiveness. The idea that God is a God who forgives, who wipes clean, who gives us new starts, who allows us to say, I repent, I believe, I want to move forward. And we can. I mean, that's what God did for us. That's at the heart of the gospel is the idea that there is forgiveness, there is newness, there are new opportunities, and you can be a new person. And that's what God is in the business of, is changing us, is growing us. And so if this has been something you've struggled with or you feel guilt or shame for, take that to God and allow Him to take that away. I thought I'd mention a powerful verse that I found helpful as we've been thinking about waiting.
Cool.
Yeah, right? So this is Psalm 27:13-14. And this is a good reminder to me. I've found this verse very comforting. I am still confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. This is just one of the many encouragements throughout Scripture having to do with waiting. But it's pretty easy to get to a place where you wonder if you're ever going to see the goodness of God. whether it has to do with sex, whether it has to do with a job, whether it has to do with emotional issues, whatever it is, we can all get to places where we feel like nothing good's ever going to come. So this reminder to be able to claim this, I am still confident of this. I will see the goodness of God in the land of the living. I will wait for the Lord, and I love this phrase, be strong and take heart and wait. You know, it feels like be strong and take heart and go get them, right? That's what you expect. But it's be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. It takes strength to wait. It's really difficult, but we can be encouraged by that. So, the man encourages those around him to wait, and presumably he is setting that, he is doing that by example as well. He is waiting. The scene shifts a little bit now, and we go back to the woman, and this is what she says. Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. My lover spoke and said to me, and we'll get to what he says in a minute. Now, he's not being creepy here, though. Don't, you know, it's not like Peeping Tom peering through the lattice. That's not the image we're supposed to see. What she's saying is, he wants to be with me. He's excited. He's leaping. He's happy to find me, and he's running to where I live. And there's this energy. There's this excitement. There's this desire to be together that he has. And that's attractive to her, right? I mean, if you show up to pick up your date and you're like, hi, let's go. You know, I mean, that really sucks, right? But if you're leaping like a gazelle, I don't know how gazelles leap, but the idea is some excitement, some energy, and that's what she appreciates in him, that she can tell he wants to be with her. So what he says to her is this, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. He's inviting her. He's inviting her out. He's inviting her on a date. See, the winter is past. The rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. The cooing of doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit. The blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one. Come with me. It's this beautiful, poetic invitation to some fancy date that he has planned for her. And he's got it bookended. He's obviously an English major in college. And so he begins and ends with the same thing. It's just really powerful, right? But what's he doing? He's just asking her out. He says, I've got this great idea. It's finally warm. Muir Woods is beautiful this time of year. I've packed a picnic. Let's go. You know? And that's great. That's really attractive that somebody would plan an event, plan a date to say, I want to be with you and I've thought about what you like and a place you might enjoy and I want to take you there and I want to celebrate it with you. So, I think one of the observations we can make here for the men is to pursue the woman in your life. If you're not dating and you want to date somebody, pursue her. Ask her out. If you're dating somebody, pursue her. Plan something special. Do something. Have this type of energy. And then next week, do it again. And the week after, do it again. And 15 years into marriage, do it again. Because this never gets old. It never loses its, you know, interest of, hey, I've got an idea. Let's go do this together. That's always attractive. The idea that you want to be with this special person and you want to do something fun with them is a powerful thing. And what we noticed last week is we saw the woman offering herself up to be invited and the man responding in an invitation. And this is, I think, probably the best picture here of the man inviting, the man planning something. And Rachel has told me this time and time again, the most significant things that we do are the ones that she can tell I spent time planning. You know, not the like, we're going on a date. Let's look at Yelp. Okay. That's not as impressive as like, I heard about this restaurant. I called 4 weeks ago to make reservations. They're expecting us. That's got a lot more points behind it. Okay. Tip to the man. So this is what this guy's doing. He's excited. He's planned this whole thing out. He's pursuing this woman.
Now, he goes on, and he says some other stuff.
Now, presumably, they're together. They're on this date, and this is what he says to her. "My dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding places on the mountainside, show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely."
And this is another beautiful picture of what this man is doing. And what he's doing is he's drawing her out.
The picture is of this dove hiding in a rocky place, trying to protect itself. And what he's doing is he's saying, "Come out. Show me who you are. I'll protect you. I'll take care of you. You don't have to protect yourself from me." And this is important because for the women in the room, a lot of times you have to, in this world, protect yourself from men. You've dated men probably that you've had to protect yourself from. You've been involved in friendships. You've had to protect yourself from people. And what happens in a healthy romantic relationship is you start to let that guard down. You start to trust this man and say, "I don't have to protect myself from you. I can trust that you will protect me, that I'm safe with you." This word that's used here, the clefts of the rock, if you remember the story of Moses, at one point Moses said, "God, I want to see you." And God said to Moses, "Hide here in the cleft of a rock, and I'll pass by. And after I pass by, you can peek out and look at me from behind." The same word here. So the idea is you need to be protected from something. You're hiding in a cleft of a rock. You're protecting yourself from threats. And yet here's this man inviting the woman out. "Show me your face. Let me hear your voice." He wants to know her. And I think this is probably the single hardest thing in a relationship. I'm amazed that people can come together and stay together, because I think intimacy is incredibly difficult, because we're all insecure. We're all afraid of really revealing ourselves. We all, I think, maybe just me, but we all think on some level of, "I got this show that's maybe okay, but if they really get to know me, if you really know what's going on, boy, that's not going to work." And so to hear someone say to you, "I want to know the real you. I want to know your heart. I want to draw you out. You're safe." And notice what he says. "Show me your face. Let me hear your voice." He doesn't say, "Show me your face so I can see how pretty you are. And let me hear your voice because I've got three judges and we're going to rate you." He says, "Show me your face. Your face is lovely." He's already decided that she's worth it. He's already made the evaluation. He's not saying, "Come out here so I can see you and see what I think." He's saying, "I know what I think. I want more of you. I've already evaluated you. I've already know that you are like a lily among thorns. I'm already crazy about you. I want to know more of who you really are." The evaluation is gone. It's not about checking her out. It's about knowing her deeply and intimately. And I think that's why we're afraid to let others know us, because we've been rejected. We've been in places where we've taken a risk, said something, shared something, and either been criticized or met with blank stares or walk away thinking, "Man, I wish I hadn't said that." And so this process of opening up to each other is another thing you start to recognize in a healthy relationship. And the other thing I'd say for this is it's not a linear process either. It's not like you open up and then you're like intimate and vulnerable, happily ever after. This is kind of a coming and going thing. And you become safe and you open up and then you go away and you come back and you have to kind of reestablish relationships. And there's this rhythm of a relationship of developing trust and establishing trust and opening up and reestablishing it and kind of this dance almost that happens. And so you'll see this happening not just once, but over and over again as you face new situations together and you have new levels of vulnerability. But this is the direction. I'm not sure exactly what we'll look at when we look at marriage, but one of the phrases, I think the most powerful phrase to describe the state of marriage happens in Genesis before sin enters the world. And it says of the man and the woman, Adam and Eve were naked and felt no shame. And I think that phrase describes the image of what marriage is supposed to be, not just on a physical level, but on an emotional, spiritual level, the idea of being completely naked before somebody, hiding nothing, and yet you don't feel any shame because you know they accept you and you know that they know you and love you, even though you've shown them everything. That's the goal. And marriage, you don't always get there, and you get there and you have taste of it, and then you have to get there again. And but this is where they're moving towards, and this is another image of that. So the last thing he says then is, catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. And so what happens is, when you start to be vulnerable, when you start to open yourself up, when relationships start to get close, there's problems, right? You say something and it's taken the wrong way, or maybe it's taken the right way, and you get feelings hurt, or you get confused, or what did you mean by that? That really hurt me when you said that. How could you say that to me? As soon as any level of intimacy gets developed in any type of relationship, there starts to be conflict, misunderstandings, hurt feelings, problems. And so he represents those as foxes. And he does this great statement where he's asking for help. It's not clear who he's addressing. Is he addressing God? Is he praying, God, help us with these problems? Is he asking the community around him, can you help us figure this out? We've got these foxes. Is he asking other people? Is he asking mentors? It's not clear, but all of those work. And the significant thing here is that as they have problems, as issues arise, they don't battle each other about them. They turn side by side and ask for help from someone else. And so very often in any relationship, a problem arises and it's like, here's one person, here's the other, here's the problem, and you're just firing missiles at each other, right? But that's not the picture of what they're doing. He's turning to someone else and inviting her along and say, we need help with these foxes. Catch them for us, whether they're praying and asking God, or maybe they're asking their community or asking for counseling or all sorts of things. But this is to be expected. There are going to be foxes. Vineyards are great places, and foxes like to eat little grapes. So if you start building a vineyard, you're going to have foxes. That's going to be the way it is. That doesn't mean your relationship is a failure. It doesn't mean that you need to, you know, throw your hands up and get out. There will be problems, but there are healthy ways to work through those. And we can be a part of that as a community. The people around you can be a part of that. God is certainly a part of that, helping us to see, helping us to guide us. And so I like this phrase that he uses, us, the foxes that ruin the vineyards. Throughout the rest of the poem, the vineyard is used to be the metaphor of their relationship. And you see the vineyard develop and bloom. And so that's what's going on here. So what's the result of this then? It's even more desire, even more passion. She says, my lover is mine and I am his. He browses among the lilies. If I'm a lily, then he browses among me. He spends his time with me. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn my lover and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the rugged hills. Wink, wink, double smile. So this is a sexual invitation. She saw him bounding on the real hills like a gazelle, and now she says, hey, I've got some hills. Why don't you be like a gazelle on my hills, okay? That's the picture that she's offering here. She's saying, enjoy me. Enjoy my body. She's inviting him into sexual activity with her. And there's this beautiful offering of each other. My lover is mine, and I am his. We belong to each other. We own each other in a sense. Not in a demanding, I own you, you're my property sense, but we have given ourselves to each other. We are connected to each other. And so again, as the relationship progresses, what is there? There's increasing desire. There's increasing sexual desire. And this is something, it gets a lot more explicit than this later. So This is an interesting book, let me tell you. And so this is an important thing for us to talk about, though, because what do you do with this? What do you do with increasing sexual desire when you're dating? How do you figure that out? Well, one thing is you get married. but as you're in that stage, you know, how far you go, how far is too far, there's all of these questions. And we're not going to talk a lot about that, but we're in a community. We all have the Spirit. We've all experienced similar things, so talk to each other about it. Look for help. You can talk to me. You can talk to other mentors in the group. But basically, what's a good picture here is that you see the woman having increasing desire, and you see the man putting on the brakes. The man's the one that says wait, and the woman is the one that is saying, hey, let's move along here. And that's not usually the way it is in relationships. Usually it's the man that wants to go farther, that wants to do more, that's pushing the woman. And this goes back to that image of what can the man offer? He can offer protection and provision. And so if he's pushing her boundaries, if he's forcing himself on her, that's the opposite of protection. That's the opposite of provision. And so what you see here is a really natural, healthy desire that she has for sex, and he says, wait until it's ready. He's the one controlling himself. And that's an amazing thing when that can happen. When the man can have enough self-control to say, this far and no farther. This is not appropriate for our relationship yet. And to develop for the woman to see that and to be free with that and to be able to trust this man that he's not going to take advantage of me. He's not going to push me to places I don't want to go. That's a really great thing. So, as way of concluding and kind of giving us a way to wrap this up, I want to go back to the first chapter and one verse that I think is helpful. And I'm going to do a little acronym action here. So, Song of Songs 1:4 says this, draw me after you. And this is another picture. This is the man inviting the woman. This is what happens in a relationship, is one person invites the other. And this is her saying to him, draw me after you. Invite me. I'll follow you. Create something. And so I want to use this word draw to suggest four things that we've seen tonight.
Desire, relationship, and wait.
Two or four? Pretty good, though. Okay, here we go. Can you read that? That's kind of hard, isn't it? Okay, first is desire. There should be desire. Desire is good. Desire should be increasing. That's totally natural. And if you read Song of Songs and you don't see desire, then you're not reading Song of Songs. So that's first thing. The second is response. What did I mean by this? Oh, you see this growing sense of him inviting and her responding. And that's how it should work, right? I mean, how does a relationship begin? One person says, do you want to go out? And the other person says, yes, right? Invitation and response. And so there's this cycle, there's this pattern of invitation and response. Somebody inviting and you invite deeper and do you want to go out again? Do you want to go out more? Do you want to do this together? Do you want to meet my parents? Do you want to go to a jewelry shop and see what's there? You know, there's this kind of progressing level of invitation. And when it's working, there's response, right? And so that's part of how you can tell if the relationship is moving forward. Is there more invitation, deeper invitation? And is she responding? Is he responding to my invitations? Is there a deepening sense of something going on? So you should look for response from each other. The A, these are the foxes. So annoyance, but it can be lots of things. There's lots of A's that work here. Maybe it's anger. Anger is a real deep thing. We all have it. We all struggle with it on some level. So maybe that starts to get expressed and you don't know how to handle that. Maybe it's, what was the other one? Anger, annoyance, arguments. Ambition. What?
Nothing.
Ambition, is that what you said?
No, yeah, that's a good one.
Arguments, right? So actually like, you know, I'm going to go here, I'm going to go there, dead heat. Don't know what to do, arguments. Or what should we do in this situation? And so whatever it is, there are going to be these issues and learning to work through them together. I think it's a good sign in a relationship that you've faced problems and you've come out them together. And when I've had that sense with Rachel, that we're able to stand side by side and face a problem together versus having the problem be in between us. It's really powerful to say we are partners, and there's this thing that's threatening our relationship, but we're going to tackle it together. And we've done that time and time again and seen God really show up there. And then the last thing is waiting. There is waiting. There's waiting for sexuality. There's maybe waiting for a relationship. There's all sorts of waiting, and that's something that God develops in us. So draw. Desire, response, annoyance, and waiting. So that is Song of Songs. And the last thing I want to just remind us of is that all of this is not just about us. It's not just about me and a girl or you and a boy or, you know, it's not just about this little relationship, but all of this is happening in the context of who God is, the idea that He Himself is relationship, that He is building relationships in the world. And so the point of romance, the point of coming together, is that God does that. And He does it for His purposes, to create fruit, to create life, to draw people together so they can understand Him, so they can participate together in God's work in the world. This isn't just about you, and it's really helpful because when you're dating somebody, it can feel so much like it's just about me. This is my life, and it's so exciting, and it's so terrible, and it's so dramatic. But all of this is happening in the context of God, and all of it helps us to connect with who God is and what He's doing. Let me pray. God, I want to thank You that You've created romance, and I thank You that You've created passion, and You've created sex, and You have created these deep, deep desires within us to connect with someone else. I pray that You'd help us to walk through those, to navigate those. I pray that You'd help the people here that are in different places, whether they're in dating relationships and trying to navigate what that looks like, trying to evaluate them, trying to figure out if they're healthy, if they should move forward or take a step back. Pray for those people that aren't dating, that want to be. I pray that You would help them wait, help them trust You, help them foster these characteristics in them as they wait, so that they might be ready for the person that You will bring them. And I pray for people struggling with past abuses, with disappointment, with guilt, with shame, with anger. There's so much when you start talking about romance that gets brought up. It's such a raw subject, and there's so many strong positive emotions and strong negative emotions around this. So I just pray for Your presence that each of us individually would experience as we experience whatever it is that this has brought up for us. Thanks, God. Thanks that You love us, that You have a plan for us and for this world, and that they're all connected, and that You work in such glorious and powerful ways. We love You, God. In Jesus' name, amen.